Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. Today is Friday, March the 24th, 2023. This is episode 3276 of the Survival Podcast. Got a good lineup from the experts for you today. Here's what I've got on the docket. In the Ron Paul Liberty Highlights this week, we'll talk about how regulations can never fix the banking system. That'll come from Dr. Ron Paul himself. Dan McAdams will talk about big changes with a stronger relationship between China and Russia. And I actually think this is a bigger story than most people understand, and we did it to ourselves. And it's going to be an interesting thing to look at when we already had kind of a rising power in China. Then we have Chris Rossini and Dr. Paul teaming up on talking about how the new deals, FDIC and SSI, Social Security, were really a false sense of security. So FDR brought us the new deal, but it wasn't really the deal that we were promised. It was the deal people chose to believe in. Then we'll talk about gearing up for canning season with Nicole Sauce, and she's got an assortment of things she recommends for that. I've got links for all of those in the show notes today. Nick Ferguson will talk about stacking pruning and propagation as a function stack when you're doing your pruning of your fruit trees. Patrick Rohrman will talk about knife sharpening systems and why he recommends the low-tech method here. And Doc Bones will talk about doctors being disincentivized to order certain labs or maybe incentivized to order other ones. Sean Mills will talk about how you know if you bought a generator that's a lemon. Does it mean it's a lemon even if it works just because it says it's so online? What do you know about the thing that you're reading somebody talk about? Then Jessica Mills will talk about choosing a trail section for a multi-day hike. It's your first overnight hike. So most people aren't going to start off with, I'm going to hike the Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine. They'll do a section hike. And I did one over 1,000 miles. Most people aren't going to do that either. They're going to do 100 miles, 50 miles, 20 miles, 30 miles, something like that. And it's a big place. So how do you pick your spot? I'll say a little bit on this, but Jessica's got it pretty well handled. And then I'm going to talk about something. I haven't done quotes of the day in a long time. But I was going through some of my past artwork from the show, and I found this quote from Harold S. Green. Janine. Harold S. Ganeen, and he said, in the business world, everyone is paid in two coins, cash and experience. Take the experience first, and the cash will come later. I'll talk about the fact that this formula works, and it's one of the greatest pathways to success in life and wealth in general, but there's also a time when you need to flip the calculus on it and no longer do work for experience because you got enough experience. And sometimes working for experience is not just about working for experience, but it's about taking a client at a break-even or even a loss or even a very narrow profit margin because their name buys you credibility. But does it? And does it buy you enough to do it? And how much is it going to cost you for how long? And are you underselling yourself? Things like that. With that, let's jump right off into it with the Ron Paul Liberty Highlights for the week.
Do you think the collapses of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank were inevitable? What methods will the government employ to further regulate and control the banking industry? Do you believe this will have much wider market impacts in the coming months?
The bank failures are inevitable. All the banks, in a way, are insolvent. And that is because money gets created out of thin air, and the government comes in and prints more money and bails them out. And that makes it where people can't depend on what the government's going to do. There's no sound rules. It's a moral hazard, the false money and the false promises. So anytime the government comes up, even what they're doing now, now is promising to solve this problem, but they're not going to be able to solve this problem because it's an insolvent system. Maybe today they've contained it a little bit, but it's not a workable system. And a country that pretends that there's no problem, the people get poorer, and some people get a lot poorer faster, and they get punished, and the wealthy people are able to gather up the pieces that are left. So there's no easy way to solve that problem, because the problem is fraud and counterfeiting of money, and you can't solve that by just real smart people that know how to regulate. And it's a false promise. It's an illusion, and it is a moral hazard, because then it gets so difficult. I've seen so many people express themselves, you know, I have this about money I've saved, and I don't know whether it's going to be insured and all this, because it's fake. Yeah. You know, there's not no honesty in the money, and that's why it's vulnerable.
And it's a three-day meeting between Xi Jinping, who was just reelected an unprecedented third time to be premier of China, and he goes to Moscow for a full three-day summit. Now, he and Putin on yesterday had an informal talk for 4.5 hours. I don't know how you do that. And then he met earlier today with the prime minister of Russia. And then they move into the formal section of their talk later on. They're already doing that now, obviously, because they're ahead of time. So it's a massive meeting, a three-day meeting again, as you say. And the U.S. media, of course, is very centered on Ukraine, and so they're saying that the whole thing is about Ukraine. It's not. This summit is about deepening ties between Russia and China, something, as you say, that would have been thought unprecedented back, especially in the Nixon era, where Nixon had the intelligence to go over there and try to be friendly with China and open the door to China. Well, of course, we've been doing the opposite since then. And you can really contrast the diplomacy if you watch how it was when Xi arrived, how he was treated, how they've talked. I mean, compare that and contrast that with modern American diplomacy, which ironically mirrors the old Soviet diplomacy toward its own satellites, which is, we say jump, you say how high. And it was just a couple of weeks ago when the U.S. administration was shaking its finger at China, saying, you better not give a single weapon to Russia. Don't you sell a single thing. And meanwhile, we've given hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons to Ukraine. So the hypocrisy is out there in the open. But this is a very, very important meeting, because it signifies the deepening of a relationship between two extremely powerful nations. As you point out, the one, Russia, which is gifted with unbelievable natural resources, and the other, China, which has been very successful in developing its economy, even though, as you also point out, not necessarily along a free market line, but probably more free market than we are these days, but nevertheless. So the marriage of these two really should spell trouble to the U.S., but the U.S. is, you know, apparently oblivious to these fundamental changes in the world.
How much of the deposits are going to be insured? People are very nervous about that, and there's a lot of hustling around there. But if we go by the government's promises, no sweat. The FDIC there is to help us. They claim anybody that's been insured for a deposit has never lost a penny, and they came into existence in 1933. Well, I think that figure is fudged a little bit. And Chris, why don't we start off with seeing how much reassurance you can give us and tell us, oh, Ron, you're worrying it too much. I checked into it, and the numbers aren't all that bad. I think they can handle it all right. Chris.
I have some bad news, Dr. Paul.
Oh.
There are $9 trillion in deposits, and the FDIC has $125 billion to cover it, which is about 1.4%. That's not going to cut it. You know, we gave Ukraine $100 billion.
Right.
So basically, Ukraine is going to cover our deposits. You know, it's imagine taking like $10,000 to a CEO, multimillionaire, and say, hey, buddy, you get in trouble, I got your back. I mean, he would laugh at you. Your $10,000 wouldn't even cover his shaving cream. So it's a false sense of security. But that, you know, Dr. Paul, you mentioned 1933. That's New Deal stuff. There's another one called Social Security, which is another false sense of security. Because, again, you know, people think, well, I put money into it. You know, I hate, again, to be the bearer of bad news, but there's no money sitting there. They don't take it, put it in a corner, and say, this is for when so-and-so retires. We're going to responsibly keep it here for him. And when he retires, we're going to give him the money. Nope. They spent it. It's gone. There's all debt there. So, you know, this new deal that came about in 1933 was a raw deal. They didn't save capitalism. They destroyed it and created this whole big fiction that now is coming home to roost, and people are being surprised at the level of problems that we're already starting to face.
Well, I don't have a lot to add to that one. I'll just say I agree with Dr. Paul. The banking system can't be fixed for two reasons. Regulatory capture, meaning the people that are supposed to regulate the banks are paid for by the banks, so that's just not going to work. And then two is the sheer amount of money, and I don't think that there is any mathematical way to ever make the calculus work, and they know it, and that's why they're building a replacement. But they have to phase it in over time, lest they cause a panic and attempt to escape. That's the game that's afoot there. The changes with China and Russia's relations, if you're shocked that China and Russia are shacking up as butt buddies now, then you didn't have any foresight whatsoever when the U.S. cut Russia off from its ability to do commerce with Western nations. The only thing Russia had as a choice was to turn to the largest economy that didn't give a shit that America didn't like it. That would be China. I'm actually surprised it's taken this long to end up where it has. And the FDIC and Social Security also being a false sense of security, I agree with that too. I remember Bernanke on the floor of Congress testifying about the ability of the Fed to cover the cost of Social Security. And they said he said we will always be able to cover the cost. We will always be able to cut the checks, but we can't guarantee the value of the money. Well, the value of the money is the only thing that actually matters to the person receiving the money that you stole from them their entire life. And Chris Rossini's right. There is no money in Social Security. Remember Al Gore? Well, put it in a lockbox. I'm so old I remember the lockbox. Some of you don't. But Al Gore, when he was running for president against W. Jr., that's what he kept saying. We're going to put Social Security away where it belongs, in a lockbox. As though people were raiding the Social Security fund to pay for things other than Social Security. They're not. There's barely enough money in Social Security on a given month to cover the cost of it in a month. You pay Social Security. It's not put away for you. Your Social Security payments go to somebody that's been retired for 15 years right now. That's how it works. It's a Ponzi scheme. And if you don't have enough people working in the future, earning enough more money, you can't pay the old people, the people that keep coming into retirement age. I'm going to tell you right now, they are going to do three things I guarantee you are going to happen. One, and this will happen within the next 10 years, and whoever does it is dead meat for doing it. That's why nobody wants to, but they're going to have to. They're going to raise Social Security taxes by something, probably about 1-2%, which will be, if it's a 2%, it'll be 4, because remember, your employer matches the other side of it. The next thing they're going to do, this almost doesn't count, there's 4 things you're going to do. They're going to raise the cap significantly. So right now, once you go over a certain amount of earned income, you stop paying Social Security tax. They're going to jack that number way up, way, way up. The next thing that they're going to do, they're going to increase the age of retirement, probably minimum to draw anything 67. And so they're going to do that too, whether you believe it or not. And the thing is, it is a Ponzi, and that's the only way to make it appear to stay solvent for some longer period of time. But yeah, they're going to raise the rate. They're going to raise the cap. And they're going to raise the age of retirement. And what they won't do is anything that will affect people already drawing it. And those will be the people that they scare the most, the opposition to it will, right? So what will happen is there'll be a 71-year-old person who's been drawing Social Security for, you know, 6 years, what have you. And this change will be five years in the making when they pass it. It'll be like 5 years this will take effect, you know, in stages over time. And that person, that 71-year-old, will be the one that votes for whoever the other side is, because they'll be told they're going to take your Social Security away, and they'll believe it. Do you know how I know that? Because I've seen it happen before. This is the formula for when I was a kid, what Ronald Reagan did. When he saved Social Security, it was the largest tax increase on the American people in history. That's right. the president that created the largest tax increase on the American people in history, Ronald Reagan. Let's go on and talk about something better. How about Nicole Sauce gearing up for canning season?
Howdy, TSP. Nicole Sauce here with a question from John. And John asks, what should I be doing to get ready for canning season? It turns out John has never canned before, but is expecting to have some surplus this year as they increase their food production from the property. And this is my thought on canning. First of all, canning is not hard. And a lot of people are hesitant to start, but once you get into the rhythm of it and you start and learn how to do it safely, it actually turns into a pretty cool way to put a bunch of food up that does not take up a bunch of freezer space. So I always recommend folks start by learning to can high acid foods, and that would be fruits and pickles, jams and jellies, those sorts of things. I even have a webinar series over at Living Free in Tennessee that takes you through different steps of canning. So you start with water bath canning, you move on to jams and jellies, you do pickles, and then you go into the pressure canning, which are the low acid foods, meats, green beans, corn, that sort of thing, soups and stews and broth. But if you want to get ready for the canning season, now is the perfect time to A, learn how to do it. So if you can take a class in your area, take a class. If you want to grab my webinars, just head over to livingfreeintennessee.com and do that. But also think about what supplies you're going to need, because what happens every year with canning is that supplies run out when you need them the most. Lids run out, jars run out, all of that. So I would recommend first choose your canner. If you are friends with somebody who has a canner, see if you can just borrow theirs for this season if you're not sure you like canning. But if you know you like canning, think about what kind of canner am I? Am I somebody who's going to spend all weekend long running multiple batches on my stovetop when I harvest bushels and bushels of green beans? In that case, you want to get the All-American canner and the biggest one you can get. Or if that's out of your budget, get the Presto canner and get the biggest one you can get. Even if you only think you're doing water bath canning, consider getting a pressure canner out of the chute, because you can use it for both a water bath situation and a pressure canning and a situation. And if you do end up progressing in a year or two from I only do high acid foods, water bath style, to dang it, I really need to can some of this venison because there's no room in my freezer, you'll have it and it's ready to go. If you are more of a hobby canner, or you're doing a little bit every day, consider an electric pressure canner. There are two on the market. One is the Nesco that Jack Spierko recommends. You can find that over at tspaz.com. Sorry, it's like I'm talking to Toolman Tim today in my head. So tspaz.com. Or Presto makes one, and that one is, in my opinion, better than the Nesco for two reasons. One, the controls are easier to use. And the Nesco one has some weird, funky instructions that don't quite match what you really need to do to pressure can things. Secondly, it takes 5 quarts instead of 4 quarts. And for me, having that extra quart makes all the difference. Now, an electric pressure canner, as long as you handle your jars the same, it's sort of a set it and forget it thing. You get it going. It has a computer in there to make sure it stays under pressure. And it runs through the timing and cools, and then eventually you take things out. If you are going to use a electric pressure canner, though, it is better not to just let off the pressure and take the jars out quickly. When you do that, what happens is the cold air hits the jars and you have boiling, things boil out, the canning is not as good. So do let it cool down in the pressure canner. Whether it's electric or stovetop, you will have much better results. Finally, if you're going to want to source a lot of lids, you can get them in bulk at laymans.com or Fillmore. And last I checked, they have some in stock now. If you get there and they're out of stock and they have a notify me button, hit the notify me button, because they will have cycles of them in stock. Otherwise, you can grab them at pretty much any Ace Hardware store, any Walmart. You can look online. I try not to buy the knockoff varieties that have a white rubber ring. I like the red rubber ring under there. And then jars, I prefer to get brand name jars, Ball or Mason, one of those two, over getting the cheaper jars that you can get at Dollar General or somewhere like that. And here's why. I have more breakage in the ones that are not name brand, but even the name brand ones are not as good as they were a decade ago. So if you can get, like, look on Facebook Marketplace, Craigslist, wherever you go, LSN, wherever you see things, you find used jars that are old, just make sure they're not chipped on top, and those are fantastic. My opinion on jars is if you can get the wide mouth ones over the narrow mouth ones, do that because they're more versatile, and also because I can get my whole hand in there to clean it, which is sort of nice. So once you have all that, having a canning kit, and they sell these at Walmart and other stores like that. They sell them on Amazon where it has a jar lifter, a magnetic lid lifter, and the funnel, the jar funnel to get the, you know, tomatoes or whatever into your jar without slopping them everywhere. Well worth the money. They're about $30 for that kit. I'd recommend that as well. Once you have that, you just need to think about where am I cooling the jars, because you need to set them aside for 12 to 24 hours while they cool down. I like to use either towels on the countertop or giant cutting boards. Sometimes when I have a lot of canning, though, I will bring in a outdoor table to my inside and use it so that I can still use my kitchen counters while the jars are cooling. And then think now about where you want to store your jars. You want to be in a cool, dark place. That means out of direct sunlight and probably not in an outbuilding if you freeze. That'll be a little too cool or a little too hot. So think about where you're going to store these jars, because that's just as important that you store them well. Otherwise, the lids could pop up. Anyway, those are all my thoughts about what you may want to have on hand. Definitely think about how many jars you think you'll need this year and the lids now, and start sourcing them rather than waiting for midsummer, because usually by July, it starts getting hard to find these things. And in a year where more people are conscious and worried about supply chain disruptions, you may see that there is a repeat of 2020 when they had four times the demand for canning supplies over the year before and were not prepared to produce that much. Hope this helps you out, John. Guys, if you have questions for me, you can send them over to Jack. Just put TSPC expert in the subject line. Make it a great week.
So just on the canner itself, the Presto one looks really interesting. I don't need another canner, but it's interesting enough that I would consider it. Except what? I'm glad you asked. I don't know what this thing is supposed to cost. And I don't know if it's just that there's only third-party sellers with it on Amazon right now, and it's sold out, and when it's back in stock, the price will go down to something much more reasonable. But when I pulled up the Presto canner that Nicole's mentioning, which looks like a really great piece of equipment, instead of giving me a price, it says, see all buying options. Usually that's a bad thing on pricing, and in this case it is. So the lowest price is from a company called Factory Depot, and it is $285.50. And it goes up from there up to some sellers charging well into the $300 range for it. Conversely, the Nesco Carry one that I recommend has had its time where it's been, you know, in that inflated cost because it's only been third-party sellers. And right now, it is temporarily out of stock. But it looks like they'll let you place your order and ship it when it becomes available. And they have it marked down because of that 33% to $113. Nicole's right. The instructions that come with it are not great, but I think you can figure it out in about 3 seconds, because I did. I never even read the instructions on it. We use ours a lot. It works really good, and I still recommend it. Now, I'm back, too, on this. I like one more quart. I like the additional controls, and I like that it's a newer model, and I think it's probably a great piece of kit. And my question would be, and I just didn't have time putting this episode together today, is it maybe a lot more affordable? And when I said that, I realized that was stupid, and I hit pause, and I looked it up, and the retail on it is $329.99. Okay. How would I come at this right now from my angle of product recommendation? If you already own the carry, I personally won't spend my money on this. I'm not going to spend this much money on a product that does something that I already have. If I didn't own it, I have to say it would be very hard for me to buy it just because it does one more core, unless it does something I don't know. Here's my rationale. Say it's just round it off to $300, and then we'll just round the Nesco one I recommend to $120. I can buy one of these for $300. I can buy two of those for $240. You see where I'm going with this? I can't get there unless this has some level of feature set that I'm not aware of and I'm missing. That's just a pure financial choice. I'll bet you it probably is a better piece of equipment, though, overall. It's just you have to decide if it's worth the money to you. Now, I know the one thing it does do, from what Nicole said, is it has basically a water bath canning setting, too, which doesn't can at the high pressure. Okay, again, though, I can do that with a pot and a rack and a lid that I already have. But then I'm not using electric, and I can always just do a shorter cycle pressure can for a water bath can recipe. So I can't get to the $300 plus on it, but maybe I'm missing something, and it's damn good, or Nicole wouldn't even be mentioning it. Anyway, with that, let's move on to something else. Let's talk about function stacking when you're doing your annual fruit tree pruning.
Nick Ferguson here with an answer for Rich on function stacking. I'm in the middle of sorting and bundling thousands of trees for rare plant store sales, so let's jump right into it. This question is from Rich. Can you function stack pruning with propagation in fruit trees? Absolutely. I want to begin propagating my fruit trees from cuttings. Is there any reason why this can't be done by using portions of the tree that needs to be pruned? Are these done at different times of the year or require special types of trimmings? Yes. What is the best method for success? We're in northern Vermont. Thank you. That's good details. We planted 6 apple trees last season and we'll be adding cherry, plum, pear, and peach trees soon. Thanks, Rich. Absolutely, you can and you should, but here's a catch. You're not rooting those apples, cherry, plum, pear, and peach trees. They oftentimes do not root very well. You'll need to be grafting them. I would focus on pruning for good form and growth this winter if it's not too late to prune where you are. Trees are already leafed out here in Louisiana, so it's far too late for pruning where I live. I do my pruning in January, February when it's the coldest months because we generally have like 1 or 2 months where it's cold enough to prune. So, do not assume I'm saying you should be doing winter pruning where you are in Vermont because I have no idea if your trees are already pushing sap. You don't want to prune after they're pushing sap because then they could just kind of bleed to death. They're going to push a whole bunch of the sugars out of the ends of those cuts, and that's not good for the tree. You want those cuts to be able to heal over and the vascular structures to close before it starts pushing sap so that the sap goes into the tissues and pushes into new buds and helps it grow this year. You don't want that all draining out on the ground, just like blood. But if you're doing winter pruning, let's just assume it's not too late for you. That's the ideal time to be taking first year scion wood for grafting later in the winter, and you can graft even into early summer. You just have to store that scion wood in plastic bags moist in a fridge. Basically, that's the short answer. And you harvest that scion wood for grafting in the middle to late winter before that sap is pushing and before buds are breaking. And that scion wood is used to graft onto appropriate rootstock. This is apples to apples, cherry to cherry, pear to pear. There's some flexibility with the stone fruits like cherry, plum, and peach. But let's not get into that advanced stuff. These types of fruit trees, you know, all those that I just listed, generally they don't root well on their own roots. If they do, it can take a long time to mature that tree enough to begin fruiting. Sometimes they have, those cultivars have disease problems if they're on their own roots, which is why people graft them, because they graft much easier than they root. You have much higher success rate with grafting those types of fruits than you do with trying to root them. It's a lot more labor intensive to root those types of trees. Pear is the easiest thing in the world to graft and should be a walk in the park. That's the first type of tree that I would start out trying to graft. So if you're a brand new grafter, pear is one of the easiest things to graft. I'll have a ton more info on propagation in an upcoming homestead nursery course that covers plant propagation methods like rooting softwood, hardwood, semi-hardwood cuttings, as well as grafting and other methods. We're going to be covering all the topics on how to set up a homestead-sized nursery, so stay tuned for that course to drop in the next few months. I wish I had more time, but I've got to get to sorting more trees because people are itching to get their hands on trees they ordered back in January, and I'm starting to ship out on Monday. Also, I want to extend a big thank you to everyone who ordered from us again this year. I'm seeing a lot of repeat names, and we did about 67% more in sales this year over last year. That's a big jump. So this whole nursery thing is really taking off, and we really appreciate all your support and look forward to offering more and more cultivars as the years go on. The boys and I just put in 5 cultivars of grapes, 18 new types of blackberry and raspberry type cane fruits, and 13 new types of blueberry cultivars. And as soon as they're ready to propagate, we will have a lot more exciting fruits for sale. I hope your year is starting out as well as ours is. And best of luck in this new growing season. I'm Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com. Do good things.
Yeah, good stuff from Nick. There are some trees that do root well. I've had people tell me they've had good luck rooting hardwood cuttings on apples. But the people that did that also told me they stuck like, you know, 100 cuttings and got like 30. So you would probably be much better off grafting as Nick is recommending here. Now, there are some trees that specifically root well, and what roots even easier for you than hardwood cuttings is softwoods. And examples would be certain species of mulberry, Mora alba issi, which is the dwarf mulberry, that grows more in a shrub form. That stuff, the minute you get a good softwood, and a good softwood, it's still green, it hasn't turned brown yet, but when you bend it, it doesn't flop, it kind of snaps, but it stays together. It's got a little snap to it. That stuff, you can't help but root, willow roots, but most of the fruit trees, Nick's right, you'll probably have a pretty low hit rate if you're just trying to root cuttings off of most of them, especially if you're not doing something like intermittent mist. Next up, let's talk about knife sharpening systems with Patrick Rohrman.
Hey guys, this is Patrick with MT Knives coming to you today with today's expert counsel question of the week. This week's question comes from James. James says, Patrick, what is your opinion of the Wasabi knife sharpening system being advertised on Facebook? I use a Lansky system with the oil stones that are about a half inch wide. I have a Kershaw safety knife I sharpen every week at 25 degrees. I really only use the Lansky for my pocket knives because of its small and use a cheap pull through for my kitchen knives. The Wasabi looks much larger than the Lansky and it uses water stones instead of oil stones. It's also demonstrated sharpening much larger knives. I was wondering if you had an opinion on this and if you could briefly discuss sharpening stone angles for applications. Maybe you recommend something completely different. Thank you, James, MSB member. Well, thank you for the question, James. And, you know, anybody who's listened to several expert counsels is probably already know what I'm going to say. I always recommend people learn how to sharpen by hand. And kind of ditch the sharpening systems. However, of the sharpening systems, you know, the, I believe you said the Lansky system, and then this Wasabi. I actually feel like of the different systems out there, they are a decent concept on like how to sharpen the knife. They're using jigs. It's going to help you hold the right angle, and you know, it's using stones and all that. So as far as, you know, whether or not it will do a good job, I have no doubt that it will do a good job. Now, the being using water stones, water stones tend to break down faster than oil stones, and so that you're going to have to flatten those stones to get them, you know, more often you're going to have to work those stones to make sure that it's, you know, not deviating from the angle that you want it to do. So that being said, you know, all these systems are going to be slower and have their limitations than just learning how to hand sharpen. And I recently just did a new sharpening course with School of Traditional Skills, and they flew like 5 or 6 different people out here to my shop from all over, from California and Idaho and Minnesota. And I had my shop full of film crew for 3 days. And we shot, you know, 8-hour days for 3 days. And they put together a really excellent course. I'll include a link to that course with this episode. But I think you'd be money ahead to buy some stones and learn how to sharpen freehand. And, that's going to be my recommendation, you know, 99% of the time. However, you know, if you've tried freehand and you just don't want to take the time that it's going to take to get good at it, and you just want a jig system, I think the Wasabi system would be a decent system, you know, especially if you're already familiar with the Lansky and you're happy with it. I'm saying it's going to be a similar system. I have not used that system, so all I know is what I've seen on the ads. As far as angles go, the angle that you sharpen a knife is going to depend on many different things: the steel, the user, and the use. So the nice thing about sharpening your own knives and being able to adjust the angle is you can dial in that edge to suit you. That, you know, there's always going to be people that are going to be more hard on the knife, and they're going to, you know, they're going to have that knife dull within a day, maybe within an hour of using it. And so you can kind of cater to that person by sharpening, you know, using a steeper angle, a more obtuse angle on the cutting edge. So basically, you know, a kitchen knife is going to be a pretty low angle. You're going to sharpen your knife, and if you feel like it's not staying sharp enough long enough, then you want to raise up that angle, give it a beefier edge. You're going to lose some cutting performance, but it's going to stay, it's going to hold the edge better because it's got a stronger edge. Now, if you feel like your knife is staying sharp long enough, but you don't feel like it's slicing as, you know, as sharp as you would like it, you can drop that angle down. And you're going to drop it down and drop it down until the point where, you know, you roll that edge right away. So, and when you find that the edge just rolls right away and it loses cutting performance, then you just want to bring it back up from wherever that is. So the nice thing about learning how to sharpen yourself or sharpening your knives yourselves is you can really dial it in to the sharpness and the edge that you like. So anyways, I hope that helps, James. That sharpening course that was put on, that Skill of Traditional Skills has put together, I feel like they do a really good job of breaking it down into, you know, easy to digest lessons for a beginner. to learn how to hand sharpen a knife. And so, yeah, if that's something you want to check out, I'll leave a link in the show notes. But once again, thank you very much. This has been Patrick Rohrman with MT Knives. Have a great day.
So I get what Patrick's saying. In fact, when he said, some of y'all know what I'm going to say, I'm like, yeah, I know what you're going to say. And I agree to a point. I would say one thing. I was not familiar with the Wasabi system. And what it looks like is something that's more along like a diamond sharpening steel, but it's one-sided, I guess, unlike something you would use sort of like a honing steel. It is just a typical sharpening steel. They make some that are diamond cutting, and it kind of sort of looks like that. And it attaches to a counter or a desktop, and it holds an angle, and it basically allows you to move that sharpening stone that's more looks more like a file and maintain the angle because the jig is holding the angle for you. And I agree. I think it would work really well. Where might it work better than a stone? Is there a place where it might work better? I can tell you, and I don't know what other knives it may include like this, or maybe it might include some things that aren't knives, more like a machete or something, or a hatchet or an axe. And the one place I can be sure, though, that I think it would work better because of how it's designed is a karambit-style knife with a hook-style blade. I can tell you that I don't know a person that's a better person with a stone than Patrick Rohrman. And I gave him one of my karambits, my folding karambits, from Fox Knives. And he was not able to get a good edge on it. He just wasn't. And he tried. So I can look at this and say, with that tool, I could get at this blade the way that I want to across the full duration of the blade. So there may be some specific knife patterns or tools that maybe actually have a difficult, and that's the only one I've ever encountered that you couldn't just throw on a stone and sharpen easily enough. But because that one exists, it just hints to me that there might be some other ones. But this Wasabi one looks pretty cool. You guys know I like the little Ken Onion belt sharpener, and it's like a mini version of the big industrial one Patrick has. He didn't like it, but I think it all depends on what you're sharpening and how often you're sharpening. Anyway, next up, Doc is going to talk, Doc Bones, about a doctor refusing to order tests, and then the patient ended up having to pay out of pocket to get them done without a doctor. And our doctors disincentivized to order tests. Doc's going to talk about something that I agree with. I've seen a lot of times doctors ordering unnecessary tests. But maybe some tests are just expensive, and insurance companies don't want to pay for them, so they say they don't really need to do this. But Doc would know more about this than me, so let's hear from Doc Bones.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning 4th edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Today's question for the expert counsel comes from Josh, who writes, are physicians negatively incentivized to order labs for patients? My wife has a thyroid issue and can never get the endocrinologist to order all the labs she needs or requests. We end up ordering and paying for blood work on our own that isn't covered by insurance, and makes me wonder if the docs are financially disincentivized to order expensive labs in the same way they're rewarded for prescribing drugs. Josh, interestingly enough, the question I usually get is about a doctor that orders too many tests, putting people through sometimes uncomfortable and always costly studies and procedures. We'll talk about that and why that happens in a future segment. You don't tell me what tests your doctor won't perform on your wife or the tests you want done, but I assume they're related to the thyroid. These might include a TSH test, usually the first test done to see if you have too little thyroid function or too much, hypo or hyper. Other studies include the amount of actual thyroid hormone in the form of T4 or T3, thyroid antibody tests that can identify autoimmune conditions where your immune system is attacking the organ, and then there are diagnostic tests like ultrasounds and CT scans with radioactive uptake of the thyroid to look for nodules, cancers, and other studies. Other tests may be ordered not related to the thyroid if deemed useful. Now, if your wife is pregnant or breastfeeding, some X-ray imaging may not be appropriate. Attempts to limit services and tests might be born of good intentions in some cases. It's good to eliminate waste and cut down on healthcare costs, at least until it comes to your own health and that of your loved ones. Some studies may be painful, like a thyroid biopsy, or may put you at risk for complications, such as hitting a blood vessel. Other times, the doctor doesn't order a test because it wouldn't change your course of action with regards to a problem. There are constraints that encourage physicians to limit medical care expenditures. As costs rise, insurers and the government pay for it by raising your taxes and premiums. Now, I've been retired for a while, but managed health care passed the buck to physicians a lot in the past who bore some financial risk for recommending tests, performing procedures, and making referrals to specialists. Proponents of this say this persuaded physicians to cut out wasteful tests and unnecessary procedures that may have harmed the patient. HMOs decide how much they'll pay for each service. Then they contract with doctors and hospitals who agree to accept those payments. In some cases, HMOs pay doctors a fixed amount each month for each patient they see. An HMO also eliminates unnecessary treatments, quote unquote. HMOs are usually only paid for treatments or procedures they can show are effective. They may require their members to try less expensive tests or treatment, for they'll cover ones that cost more. In the past, many HMOs used to reduce a doctor's income when the volume of services and specialist referrals exceeded a target amount, often by withholding a portion of payments in an escrow account. I have no idea if this is happening now, but even then it was considered ethically questionable. Hopefully that's not the way it's being done now. If you feel that your wife's doctor isn't really addressing your concerns, you can ask some questions like, what else might be going on in her case? In other words, you should be persistent in trying to find out what is going on and getting your questions answered. Another thing people should do, although you've already done it, Josh, is to seek out a specialist. Many general practitioners treat simple thyroid problems, but yours may not be so simple. Ask for a referral to a doctor who specializes in thyroid disease if you're not already seeing one. I will say that it's important to present symptoms concisely and in an organized manner. Sometimes the history that a patient gives a doctor can be a long and winding road, and a provider, I mean they're only human, can get lost trying to find a reason for every symptom. This leads to losing the big picture with regards to the primary problem, and actually could also lead to too few or too many tests done. Be firm in asking for further evaluation, but not combative. Sometimes it's helpful to have a second opinion from another provider. A fresh set of eyes is a good thing, especially if your current one refuses to do at least the screenings that I've mentioned. You should seek another medical practice that will listen to your concerns more seriously. Different doctors have different approaches to evaluating a patient, and you just might not have found one that meets your needs yet. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, please consider supporting our mission by getting some of the quality medical kits, individual supplies, and personal protection gear available at store.doomandbloom.net. The Member Support Brigade gets a discount on every purchase.
I'm just back to the healthcare system has become a garbage pail. That's all I can say here. And it's nothing against Doc's answer. It's a very detailed answer and took about every angle you could on the situation. And as usual, with an expert's answer, it's far better than any answer I could have given you. But this kind of thing right here is why I think the new model is an HSA. The absolute cheapest covers the littlest, highest deductible health insurance you can get, so you don't go bankrupt if you get in a car wreck or have cancer or have a cardiac arrest or something like that. And a direct primary care doctor that won't give you the runaround like this. And yeah, you'd still be paying out of pocket, but a lot of times these DPCs are able to get your lab work done much less expensively than paying out of pocket and doing it yourself. And it also is the case that you have a doctor who will take your freaking calls and actually care about you. Because they can, under their model, they can make enough money with few enough patients to actually care about their patients. And so it's called direct primary care. And I tell anybody, it's worth looking into. And one thing you can do, instead of making a giant change in your life, find one and tell them, look, we're going to hire you for a couple months and see how this works. And if it does, then I'll make the backside changes and keep you. And if it doesn't, I'll find somebody else. I think it's becoming the only way to go if you can afford it anyway. And it doesn't have to really cost much more. It really doesn't. Because, again, What you're looking for then is and of course the government's ruined that too. And that's pretty much what I had before Obama fixed it. And I was completely happy with it, and I was paying about $90 a month for health insurance and throwing about $100 a month into a health savings account for just myself and another $100 for my wife. And we never had a problem paying our medical bills ever until they fixed it. And we never really complained about our health insurance costs until they fixed it. Translation, government shouldn't fix things. And what you have with this is it's not just the government, it's the government, the insurance companies, the drug companies, the medical device companies, and doctors, not so much the individual doctors, but the doctors' unions like the AMA, all of them together, all of them are working together, not so much for your good, but they're also all working against each other, each trying to keep their piece of a giant multi-trillion dollar pie. It's just a garbage pail, and I don't know what it's going to take to fix it other than enough Americans decide to actually take care of themselves. And I think we talk a lot about exiting the systems, but the one we don't talk about exiting enough is the medical system. You're crazy, Jack. How do you exit the medical system? Well, stop eating garbage would be the first way. If you look at what the average person goes to the doctor for, they go to the doctor for illnesses that don't require a doctor. They go to a doctor for annual checkups and stuff like that. They go for immunizations and stuff like that. And they go, by and large, most adults that go to the doctor are being treated for lifestyle illnesses. That's just the way that it is. And the more of us who will fix that through diet and activity and taking care of ourselves and don't darken the door of the doctor's office for all these lifestyle illnesses, the system will have to change to serve a healthy society. And that's the real problem here. And I'm not picking on anybody that has any kind of medical condition. Who knows why this gentleman's wife has this? It may have nothing to do with what I'm talking about. But the fact that so many do still affects you, whether it's you or not. You understand? And right now, we have a sick society. So we don't have a healthcare industry. We have a sickness and illness industry. And if you want a wellness industry, you have to have an overall well society. Just my thoughts. Moving on, how do you know if the generator you bought's a lemon or not?
Hey, everybody. This is Sean Mills with HackMyHomestead.com. And today I've got an expert panel question on a Briggs & Stratton inverter generator. I own one of these. Even though this is not my area of specific expertise, I'm going to go ahead and answer based on my experience and then perhaps another expert council member might have some additional information. So here's the question. Did I buy a lemon? Details. I recently bought a Briggs & Stratton Q6500 inverter generator on clearance from Canadian Tire, knowing that it couldn't be returned. I took it home and then did my research. Reviews were mixed, but some people were claiming that it wouldn't run even moderate loads. One video I watched was saying that it puts out low voltage on QPT, which is quiet mode. He sends a link to the video and says, this video shows it running at 104 volts. I understand that this can be damaging to some equipment. I have not done any stress testing like the guy in the video I linked to. Would a simple multimeter tell me what I need to know? Mine is model number 030766. I mention this because it differs slightly from the one in the YouTube video in a few minor ways. Mine has breaker reset buttons under each individual outlet. This specific model seems to be exclusive to Canadian Tire, possibly a bad sign. I'm not using it as a whole house generator, just running deep freezers and a power outage. Thanks. I have heard about the low voltage from Briggs & Stratton inverter generators before, but I have yet to hear of a single person who actually had a device go bad from this. I personally own the 4,500 watt version of this generator and ran the house off of it for a week when we had tornadoes a few years ago in Alabama. I've used it extensively at our off-grid house as a backup generator. One thing to remember about voltage is that the rating is a nominal rating, so it doesn't mean that your devices won't run on slightly higher or lower voltages. Watts, as I always say, are amps times volts. And the issue created when you have lower amperage is in order to work, in order to get the number of watts you need to push the thing, right, to do the work, you need more current or more amperage through the device, which can cause it to heat up and become damaged. Now, we'll say most modern freezer and refrigerators have built-in overtemp protection. If you were to plug a kilowatt meter into the extension cord and then plug your device into that, you would get the actual voltage under load. This is an important number because your generator may be throwing out low voltage under low idle, but when it gets a load on it, the engine will increase the RPMs, and that might bring the voltage up to a normal range. I'd be happy to hear if anyone else on the expert council has any different ideas for this quote-unquote problem. I appreciate the question, but just to reiterate, while I've seen people do tests and say, hey, look, this is 104 volts, not 120, I've never seen anyone say, my refrigerator was plugged into this and it doesn't work anymore because under load, the voltage was so low that it increased the amperage and that burnt out my compressor. So I think this is probably a little bit of a nothing burger. If you've got very sensitive electronics, you shouldn't be running them off of a generator anyways, at least not without something in between that's going to clean that power up. So generally, like I say, I would say go for it. I don't think it's going to be a problem. I've heard some people say, oh, this is Chinese crap and Briggs & Stratton just put their name on it, but I haven't found any evidence that this is Chinese crap. I mean, I think everything is in one way or another built in China these days. It seems like even the cars that are primarily assembled in the United States contain a significant amount of components from China or overseas in general. So, like I said, I've got the 4,500 watt version of this generator with, I think, 120 or 140 hours on it, and nothing I've ever had plugged into it has given me any issues. So I would say, from my opinion, you're good to go, but if there may be another expert council member who might be able to add some additional color, or maybe Jack can add some additional color to that answer. All right, guys, we'll keep the answer or the questions coming in, and I'll keep getting the answers out. Thanks, and have a good one.
What I think is interesting is person's asking the question, do I have a lemon, but they don't actually have a problem with the generator. They read something about the generator that somebody wrote online that says something could happen. Well, you could get hit by a meteor. And you know, I'm just going to say that there is a case for online research. It's where I always start mine. But if you research anything, you will find people telling you that it's bad or it will kill you. I mean, you will. Like, the internet is wonderful, and it also cuts the other direction at the same time, in that there will always be somebody that insists that they know for sure this thing's going to blow up the world, and then it usually doesn't happen. So I think you have to take the preponderance of reviews, and you also have to look at, rather than I looked at it and I put a meter on it and I think this could happen, when you have something like made by a company like Briggs, and you know that there's millions of them out there, if you don't have a lot of people saying, hey, it actually happened, it probably isn't that big of a risk. That's just my... And that's not on this product. That's on anything. Because trust me, with all the research I do for products I bring you guys through T-Spaz, there's somebody that says everything is bad. I think there's some people that all they do is run around writing crap reviews of companies they don't like. I'm just saying. Next up, let's talk about selecting a section of a trail for a multi-day hike when it's the first time you've ever done a multi-day hike, camp out in the woods, that type of thing.
Hey, TSPers, Jessica Dixie Mills here from Homemade Wanderlust over in YouTube land to answer a question for Annette. Annette says, my friend and I are going to spend a few days hiking the Appalachian Trail in summer of 2024. Can you recommend a section or sections that would be the most fun for us? We are two women in our late 40s who have never done overnight backpacking, but we love being outdoors. My friend does ballet and is in better shape than I am. However, I have started walking every day and doing leg workouts to get in better shape. We are going to spend about 4 days hiking and are hoping to walk about 30 miles or so. I've watched your YouTube videos and have told my friend about Trail Angels, how they have campfires where people play guitar, even that they give you a trail name. We have also talked about seeing the beauty that parts of the trail offers. If you could give us some ideas of different sections and maybe a recommendation on the part of the summer those sections would be best to hike in, this would give us a good starting point to plan our trip. Well, hey, Annette, and thank you so much for getting your question in. I think it's absolutely awesome that you and your friend are aiming to get out and hike a piece of the AT next year, and it's really good that you're training. I think the miles that you're estimating to do are very reasonable, but you know, getting out there in the best shape you can be will make sure that you enjoy it the most. I've actually done two different videos highlighting a section of trail in each one that I particularly enjoyed while I was out on the AT. Now, both of these sections, particularly the first one, will probably have a lot of traffic if you hit it up on a weekend. So if you're looking for that social vibe, you know, having other hikers out there, then chances are people will be sectioning these at the same time y'all are. But you can also look kind of where the bubble might be for through hikers if you're wanting to hang out with through hikers, and when they'll be going through these areas. But anyway, I'll send Jack links for those videos. But the first section I want to mention is more centrally located along the trail. It's in Virginia, because I don't know where you're coming from, but you know, the AT stretches from Georgia to Maine, so it's a pretty long trail. But there are some hostels nearby this particular section that can help with shuttles or rides, or maybe y'all will have two vehicles and don't need to worry about that because you'll just park one at either end of the section. But anyway, my first recommendation is the McAfee Knob and Tinker Cliffs area. These are well-known highlights of the AT, so this section for sure should have folks out there if you go at a good weather time. If you do what I've laid out in the video and the blog post that I'll send the links to Jack, you'll end up with about 27 miles, but you can make it a bit shorter if you want to. There's opportunity to make it a little bit longer. The best time of year for this section would probably be spring, so March to May, and then maybe September and October for the fall. You can do it in the summer, but it's going to be warm, being it's more southernish. I don't remember the exact time that I went through this area, but it was after mid-May. So that gives you an idea of when thru-hikers might be coming through. But the other section is Vermont. Vermont was one of my favorite states while I was out on the AT. It was physically a struggle, but it wasn't as challenging as New Hampshire, and it was almost as pretty, but obviously not the entire state. So the section that I'm referring to is actually around 40 miles, which I know is a little bit longer than you talked about, but it spans from Bennington, Vermont to Manchester Center, Vermont. And there is a road crossing about halfway in, so you could make it around 20 miles if you wanted to and make it two different sections. But in this section, the 40-mile stretch, you get to see two lookout towers. There's a side trail that you can take to get a free gondola ride, possibly, if they're open. And there's Stratton Pond, which is a big pond that would be nice to swim in the summertime. And then Prospect Rock. So that one's got a lot of stuff to kind of look forward to. The best time of year for this is probably June to October. But the warmer months, of course, are going to be like July and August. So anyway, I hope that that helps. Again, I've got more details about parking and where you can possibly hit up some hostels or the different shelters that might be in those stretches. So anyway, I hope that this information helps both of y'all. Again, check out the links that I'll send to Jack for the show notes. And I hope you have an amazing time together and the happiest of trails. Well, all right, y'all, be sure to check out the channel, and I'm going to be hitting up the Arizona Trail soon and share my experience out there, so if y'all want to follow along kind of live with a through hike, then you can check out the channel on YouTube under the channel name Homemade Wanderlust. All right, bye, y'all.
So I just want to comment a little bit on the conditioning and getting ready, and I would advise this to both of you guys. You're doing the one gal's doing leg exercises, and I imagine that's leg presses and squats and stuff. And one's a ballerina, already in better shape, and okay, that's fine. There's a difference between doing a leg workout and carrying your body for 7.5 miles. There just is, especially carrying weight on your back. So the weight on your back in 7.5 miles a day, and that's what it works out to with going 30 miles in 4 days, which I agree is a totally doable thing, and I don't think anything I say should dissuade you from going for it. What I would tell you is it makes a lot of sense for between now and then for you to do a hike in the 8 mile range, a day hike in the 8 mile range, and that will let you know if this is something you really want to do. And the section you pick is going to have an impact. So if you have an area near you where you can go hike 8 miles and it's pretty flat the whole way, there's not a lot of 8 mile stretches that are flat. At least I hiked from Pennsylvania up to New Hampshire, and there's not a lot of flat that I remember. There's some, and you probably don't want just flat, but there's also some that will wear you out. In Vermont, there's an area they refer to as the Wildcat, and it will wear you down hard. So I would look for some elevation change. I would get out and maybe because you got a year now, right? That's great. You know, get out, y'all, to get together and go do a 4 mile, and then the next week go do a 5 mile and go do a 6. Find the point where you really are like, that challenged me, and then spend a couple weeks hiking that distance. And I think if you do that, along with the other things that you guys are already doing, you're going to get to next summer and you're going to knock out your 7.5 mile a day average that you need to do to make that 30-mile section hike. If you decide that it is too much for you, and it might be, I don't know, you know, it's up to you, there's a couple ways to handle it. One, of course, is reduce the section, and two is to add a day. So there's the other thing I highly recommend. Y'all need to go out and do some overnights, even if you don't hike that far when you do them. Go out and go to a state park or something that has a primitive camping area. Yeah, has hiking trails. And even if you're hiking really close to your car, you know, go do your loop hike for 3 or 4 miles or whatever. Set up your primitive camp, and whatever you didn't take with you that's in your car, resist the temptation to touch it. Or if you do touch it, then make some notes. Kind of like I'll talk about running some survival drills, prepper drills by turning off your power or whatever. If you do rely on something, note it so that next time when you don't have the option, you have the thing that you need. Because I've seen people do this that have never spent a night in the woods before, or they have, but they've never done it like out of a backpack. And what you don't want is this to be surprisingly uncomfortable in some way. So by going out and experience it in pieces and parts, you're going to be more prepared for when you do it in the real world. In the military, we used to put it this way: those who sweat the most in peacetime bleed the least in wartime. And I know we're not talking about going to war, but it's kind of the same thing. You're going from an easy decision to just, I don't want to do this anymore today, to where you're going to, at a certain point, you're kind of committed. You know, 2 days into this, you're committed to the whole thing. And so, don't let that intimidate you. I don't mean it that way. I mean, just give yourself a few more trial runs. Don't just go to the gym and whatever, and then one day you're going to go do this. Go get some actual experience living out of a backpack, hiking longer distances, spending time together, understand. And I got another ad real quick here before I go to my segment today. It is great to have somebody with you when you're doing this. If something goes wrong, you have someone that can get help. You keep each other's morale up and stuff like that. But what can happen is both parties can overexert, because each time one wants to settle into a little bit slower of a pace, the other one picks it up. Now, if you're in a race of some kind or something like that, that's one thing. But when you're in a recreational activity, it's a good idea to get a feel for each other and to be comfortable with somebody saying, let's cut the pace a bit here, because you can definitely push yourself harder because you have a partner. All right, going on to my topic today. As I said, when I was looking for an image for today's show, I just simply can search all the images I've ever used on the blog, and I put in I think experts, but I put like EXP or something like that, and I didn't finish the word just to see what would come up, and I saw this, you know, quote from Brainy quote here from Harold Janine, and I was like, what is that? And I read it, and here's what it says again. It said, in the business world, everyone is paid in two coins, cash and experience. Take the experience, the cash will come later. This actually fits a theme that is in The Richest Man in Babylon, and I've been thinking as I go through this book again, I probably need to start it all over again, take notes again, and probably do a series of maybe my anchor segments coming out of that book, maybe five or six or eight things that come from Richest Man in Babylon, and make them either a segment on Expert Counsel as my anchor or a segment during some of the multi-segment shows I do on my own. Anyway, this is a good one, and it does invoke a lot of what you learn about in that book, in that the people that are storylined in it often take a job that they're not really capable of, but because they're willing to work hard and learn, they excel at it. Yeah. And there is a case for if you go to work and do a thing, you gain the experience of doing the thing, but you also gain the proof point to the next party that you might be employed by that you're capable of doing it. And it will matter more than a degree in it to have the experience in it, especially if the experience is relatively successful. And if you've done it, let's say you had 2 years of experience, and you're good at it, and your current employer won't pay you what you're worth, when you go market that experience elsewhere, it won't matter that you weren't good at it for the first 6 months. It only matters to the next person that you're good at it now. And this brings me to my point. The experience comes first, and the cash comes second. But there's a point where you, and this is true of employees, and this is absolutely true of independent business owners that have clients and customers. I don't need any more work for experience in this realm. I need to be paid better. So with running a business, there's a temptation at times to take a client for less money than you should charge just because you want to land the contract, because you want to add them to your portfolio. Here's a true real-world example of this happening where I turned the work down. So back when I was still working with Neil, and this is right up until the point where I started doing this show, one of our companies was called Franklin Spirico Media, and we did SEO, website optimization. We would do critiques on blog posts that people were going to publish, refine them, make them better, say don't do that, like things like that. We would build. We did link building campaigns to build search engine rankings for people. We came up with messaging and taglines and designs and things like that. Basic web design and marketing company. We really didn't get into the programming much. It was more the marketing side and the design side. And we actually had, and some of you guys know this, you've heard me talk about before, Donald Trump was one of our clients. Specifically an organization he had at the time called Trump University that was primarily involved in educational programs for real estate investors. And so we landed Trump, and we were literally forming the company when I created the relationship with the gentleman at the Trump organization through basically saying, this blog post you guys just did sucks, and here's why. And then another person in the organization got really upset and butthurt at me. And then he said all these things about why I was wrong, and then I went through and line by line destroyed everything he had to say and technically ripped apart what they were doing. The third party, who was the one that ended up being my contact, who this gentleman worked for, he was kind of the top guy inside Trump U, and he came and read what I wrote. Then he went and looked at our corporate blog, and he looked at some of the ranking systems like Technorati back then, and we were one of the top 25 blogs in the country at the time, so he knew I wasn't talking out of my ass. He got in touch with me. We landed that contract. So we had Trump University on our portfolio as customer zero. Pretty awesome. And we started to build out a local portfolio of corporations. And fairly decent sized ones. Nothing as big as the Trump name. Along this path, a gentleman reached out to me and was saying that he was looking for help for his company. The company was VIP Realty. This is a large company. This is a national brand. This isn't Century 21, but it's not that far away from it. And I'm talking to the CEO at this point. I can't get any higher. And basically, he starts trying to push down our rate to do the work, and he starts inferring that having VIP Realty listed in our client base was worth so much, we should basically do the work it cost. Well, I reminded him that I had Donald Trump, and this is before all the political crap when people hate him now. This is when everybody loved the guy on both sides of the aisle. At least enough people did that he was worth having as a marketing client. This is when The Apprentice was one of the number one shows on television. And I said flat out, I don't need more work for the experience. He said, well, I think I can get somebody to do this for less. And I said, well, then God bless you and go forth and find them. And I turned the work down. I tell you that story because if you build a successful business, you're going to have those moments where you don't need the experience or the clout or the notoriety anymore. What you need is the money. And the big brand that actually is the feather in the cap that you think it is can afford the bill. That's the other side of it. Do you know how much price negotiation I did with Joseph Katz at the Trump Organization when I inked that deal? None. I said, here's our cost, and this is what it covers. Do you want us to take anything out or add anything to it? And he actually said, I want two more consulting hours a week on the phone. Talking to you guys is always worth more than I pay for it. Because I'd already done some stuff basically for free as the prelim, saying this is the kind of things I would recommend. We added that to the contract. We sent the contract in. He executed the contract, sent the contract back. We filed the paperwork for the corporation on the same day we executed the contract with the customer. That's how tight that was, that we were already forming the company, but it didn't actually exist yet. Right? And so we were able to land Donald Trump as a client before the company existed, technically. And then this guy wants me to take his business just to have his name. And I ended up not doing it. If you build a business, you're going to have that. But if you work a job, you're going to get into this position too, and it will actually happen quicker. And it works like this. Bill takes a job working for this company. The company's a good company. They give him a good opportunity. He doesn't really know what he's doing, and they train him. But Bill, not being dumber than a monkey, actually takes the training seriously. And in a few weeks, he might as well have a 6 months of experience anyway. He's as good as anybody they're going to hire off the street with 6 months of experience. In a year, he's probably better than people that come off with 2 or 3 years of experience. And Bill says, I would like more money, please. And then Bill gets a standard answer. Well, I'd love to give you a raise, but I can't do it right now, which is almost inevitably bullshit. And what they're really saying is, Bill, I don't think you'll leave over this. That's what they're really saying. Or Bill's like, I really think I deserve a raise, and they give Bill a raise. But when you look at the raise, it's still under the rate that Bill would command on the open market. Because Bill's now capable. And the fact that he learned his trade working for this person only buys so much loyalty if Bill's looking out for Bill and Bill's family. Now, Bill has two choices. He can wait for somebody to retire or die in his company to move up so that he can move up in position and actually get a raise commensurate with the move. Yeah. But Bill is likely to find the following happen, even in a relatively small mid-sized company. A position above Bill will open, and the company will hire someone from outside the company into that position. Happens all the time. Or the company will hire someone that's not as good as Bill into that position internally, who has, you know, worn the knee pads, the golden knee pads, enough times to have guaranteed himself favoritism. Yeah? It happens. Or Bill might just be in a place where there's enough people at his level that are good at what they do that it's going to be a seniority thing, and even though he's really good, he's not that much better than the people with him. Now he's really screwed because he's continuing to work for the experience long after he's worth the cash. Bill needs a resume. Bill needs to accentuate everything about that job, and he needs to embellish a little bit. I'm not saying a lie, embellish a little bit. The way you phrase things is important, and Bill needs to shop his ass on the market. Bill's going to find out one of two things. His employer is not hosing him over. He's being paid what the market says he is worth, and then Bill probably is better off staying put for now. But Bill is actually more likely to find out that there's somebody out there that values what Bill can do now. And they will pay Bill more to hire him because they don't have him. And let me explain what I mean by that. What I mean is if Bill currently worked for the new company and was in the exact same situation, and let's say Bill's making $20 an hour, and his market rate should be around $26 an hour, a significant change in Bill's income. So he's making $20 in Company A, he goes to Company B, and Company B says, Bill, yes, we want you to come work, when can you start? We agree to $26 an hour. You would think if Bill was at Company B, the second one that just made him that offer, and he was making $20 an hour, and he said, you know, I've been here a long time, I'm doing a good job, I think I'm worth $26 an hour, that they would pay him the same $26 an hour. You would be wrong. No, they won't, because they're back to, I don't think you'll leave, Bill. And they would probably say something like, let me see what we can do. Right? Let me see what we can do. Well, you know, we do annual reviews, and we give raises on the end. You're only 3 months from your annual review. So Bill waits 3 months. His annual review comes up. There's a negotiation. They said, well, you know, we generally make our raises, 5%, if that. But we'll go a little further for you, Bill. We'll do 22.50. The same company that would pay him 26 off the street will offer him 22.50 from 20. And almost every time that will happen. Almost every time that will happen. Why do you think it's such a faux pas for you to tell your coworkers how much money you make? Because when one person finds out that somebody else makes more money than them, they run to HR and it makes trouble. But you know when it really makes trouble? Let me tell you when it really makes trouble. When Bill's been working at XYZ Corporation for 2 years, and he's heard multiple times they cannot afford to give him a raise, And the company hires Tom, and Tom's doing the same job that Bill was doing, and he ain't really better at it. And Bill finds out that Tom's making 20% more money than him. That's when the shit really hits the fan. And the reason that it's so frowned upon that people discuss salaries is because that shit happens all the time. I'm a hiring manager. I need this position filled. Here's the person that can do it. The day they have the most negotiation leverage with me is the day that I hire them. The day after I hire them, their leverage for negotiation goes to shit. The only way you have more leverage in a company than the day you're hired is if you are so good that you become so key and so critical to what they do that if you walk away, they're seriously hurt by it, and they still might not do it. Okay? The other way is that you are not in a position that they can leverage a non-compete against you, and you can walk away and take like $6 million worth of business with you. That will also make you highly retainable, and they will open the checkbook, and even sometimes then, spiting their own face, they won't. It's a weird thing. It's a psychological thing. I look at it this way. If I have an employee sitting in front of me, and I have the budget, and I could raise his pay to, you know, whatever X is, and if I would hire someone off the street that was as good as him and pay them X, and I will pay the guy that's already working for me X. But you know what? It doesn't happen. So if you want to continue to advance your ability to earn income, you need to move over as often as up, and often over is up. My first regional management position that I got was I was not promoted into it. I went out and I hunted down the job and I got the job. Okay? And my next one that was a regional VP, I was headhunted into the job. Because it is easier to sell yourself to somebody new that needs you than it is to make the person who already has you understand how important you are to them. And you would think, as people move up, surely this changes. Surely when Bill is a schlep and he's packing boxes, anybody can pack a box. Even if he packs them a little faster, there's plenty of box packers out there. But by the time Bill is a mid-level manager, surely he had... No, he doesn't. Well, surely by the time he's a department head, no. No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't. The only way you really get significant increases in income inside a company is to be promoted, to legitimately be promoted. Raises, they are never going to really put you ahead very much. So if you don't have the advancement to a raise through promotion and you've worn out the experience, it really behooves you to look elsewhere because there's something else about that. If my experience in job A gets me job B, I guarantee you I'm going to have new experiences at job B that I don't have at job A. Now I am once again earning experience and cash, where what has happened in the first job is I have trained myself to such proficiency that I'm no longer getting any better at what I do and I'm not adding to my skill set. There's another way, just to be fair to employers. Can you do something in your current job to become more valuable to your employer so that they will give you more money? I tried this when I was in structured cabling at the very beginning of my career. I took on the role of a salesperson. I expanded the contract I was on from having four people on it who I was running, so it was technically five, and I got involved with it at a higher level. I earned the confidence of the customer because I was a contractor to Lockheed Martin, and I was able to look ahead at what they were doing, and I was able to lock in more, instead of them going out to bid for the job, just get text from us. So we ended up with eight more techs on that job. And all that happened is the salesperson for the account, who I had never seen, just got more commission money. That's all that happened. He literally did nothing. And when I said, okay, so I want to talk about a position in sales, they said no. And that's when I went out and found that job as a regional manager. Because that's the way you get ahead. But there are companies, if you did that, would be like, holy crap, you could end up working for somebody like me, and you might not even know it. I'll recognize that person, and I am going to take that person, and I'm going to mentor them to the highest level they will allow if I'm inside a company still. And so that's your other way. It's move over to move up, right? Or move up because there's a place to move up to. Or you need to so enhance your value that they make a place for you to move up to if they're smart enough to see it. In the business world, everyone is paid in two coins, cash and experience. Take the experience first, the cash will come later. Harold S. Janine. Jack Spirico says, but once you've exhausted the experience, that part of your paycheck stops coming in. So don't work for less than you're worth. Don't quit your job until you find the place that's willing to pay you, though. It's always the way to be. With that, it's been Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this week of shows. I know I did. I'll be back on Monday with a listener feedback show, and we'll just keep chugging along. Again, this was episode 3276. Isn't that crazy? We're not that far away. It won't be summer, and we'll hit episode 3300. I guess our next kind of landmark episode. Episode 3500, couple little announcements. We haven't figured it out yet. We're going to do something this summer, though, to celebrate 15 years of the Survival Podcast. It'll be like a one-day thing or something like that. It's not going to be here at my place. It's going to be like we did the 10-year party at a really cool bar that unfortunately doesn't exist anymore. It'll be something like that. Stay tuned for that. Dorothy and I will be talking about that in the coming weeks and figure out what we can do, where, and how. The problem is summer in Texas equals a million degrees, so outside venues kind of suck. But that would be kind of fun, too, at the same time. The other thing that I want you guys to know, this is way out, but it's good to know now because many of you, you know, you plan for this. Every year we do the big workshop here in November. We're still going to do it in November. I don't know exactly what the date is going to be. Let me pull up my calendar real quick. But it is going to be... Well, my calendar wants to not work for me. Give me just a second here. So usually it's the week of November the 11th. That's Veterans Day. It just tends to work out that way. That's usually the furthest out we can put it without being too close to Thanksgiving. One of our staff members, Teresa, has a new job, and that's their inventory week, and she just can't get off and wasn't able to come last year. She's cleared it to where she'll be able to take the prior week off, so we're moving it up. So it will be the week of November 1st through November 5th. will be the week of the workshop this year. And I hope moving it up a week, honestly, will make Barter Blanket more enjoyable. The last 3 years, it has been plumb freezing cold on the Friday night where we do Barter Blanket. The 2 years ago, 2 and 3 years ago, we did it outside in the cold. People were huddled around the fire, freezing cold, going up on the porch, getting under the heaters and stuff. Last year, it was like that, plus a little bit misty, so we did it in the garage. There was good in that we had good lighting, everybody could hear well enough because we weren't outside, and everybody could see really well, and it was easy to put the table up, throw the blanket on it. It did a really good job of displaying what was being offered. The negative was it didn't have the same vibe as being outside. The other thing was that there is a point where we're, like most people are done, like, you know, it's gone on for a couple, 3 hours sometimes, and like half the people want to keep doing it and half are done. Since we were in the garage this year, we had to shut it down, and there were a lot of people with little things they still wanted to diddle over, and we had to shut it down so that everybody could, you know, use the giant garage bar. Where if we're outside, that won't happen. So I'm hoping this year, because the last 3 years, had we done it the week earlier, it would have been all nice and warm outside in the evening on that Friday. So we'll see. But if you're making plans in advance to come, you need to plan for the week of the 1st through the 5th, Wednesday through Sunday, versus what would normally be, it would have been the 8th through the 12th. So just that little announcement there, and I will catch you guys next week with another episode. Are they gonna bail you out? Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.